Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. When, if ever, does a thought cross the line and become a crime? Raw Deal is the untold story of former New York City police officer Gil Valley, who in 2012 became known throughout the world as the Cannibal Cop. It is part the controversial saga of a man who was imprisoned for thought crimes and a look into a world of dark sexuality and violence that most readers don't know exists, except maybe in their nightmares. After Valley's arrest, media coverage exploded in a frenzy of lurid tabloid headlines and stories about the cop charged with planning to kidnap, torture, rape, and eat women, including his own wife. But here's the fascinating part. There was no such plan in reality. Valley was simply engaging in his own private fantasies, albeit fantasies that are abhorrent and grotesque, and for that he was thrown into prison. Valley faced life in prison for his charges and served 21 months for nothing more than having online chats about his fantasies. Is finally exonerated of all charges. Raw Deal raises the question of when does thought become a crime? A question that goes beyond his perverse sexuality to answers societies must deal with in order to meet the challenge of terrorism. It will challenge the reader's beliefs about free speech, the right to privacy, and government's role in watching over us. The book we're featuring this evening is Raw Deal, the untold story of New York Police Department's Cannibal Cop, with my special guests, author and journalists Gil Valley and Brian Whitney. Welcome to the program, gentlemen, Gil Valley and Brian Whitney.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much. Let's start with you, Gil. Thank you very much for coming on to do this interview, and congratulations on this book. Very, very, very interesting. Let's
sure. Thanks.
Tell
yeah,
us
thanks
how
very
we
much.
Get to. Well, you're welcome. Now, tell us how you came to get a publisher to publish this story. This is basically a memoir. This is your story. So, tell us just a little bit about how you came to Wild Blue Press and how they agreed to let you write this book.
Well, there were people interested in this story for the longest time. I knew I had wanted to write a book because there was still so much misinformation out there. A lot of the facts out in the media were incorrect, and I just felt I owed it to myself and to my family and the people who supported me to get the full accurate story out there. So I hooked up with Brian. We clicked pretty much right away, and Wild Blue was one of the first, I think the first publisher we actually directly contacted, and it was important for me to tell the story the way I wanted it to, you know, it was my story, so I didn't want a situation where someone would agree and then kind of hijack the story. I wanted it to be done my way, and Wild Blue was very bold and brave because there's a lot of graphic stuff in this book, Dan, and you read it. I'm sure you can agree with that.
Sure.
So, you know, I just have to thank them. You know, they gave me the platform to finally, for the first time, and this has been going on now for 4 years, 4 years out of my life, and this is the first time the full story has been out there. So I owe them a lot for giving me the opportunity to tell my story.
Certainly, and it's for those people that have seen Cannibal Cop on Netflix, Aaron Carr's documentary, this is a lot different, an incredibly different story that is being told rather than that documentary, and we'll talk about that a little bit later as you do in your book. Now, Brian, tell us why you became interested in this story and working on this story with Gil Valley.
Sure. When it first came out, it was just all over the news, just that this really scary cop was like trying to kidnap these women, and he was going to like kidnap them, he was going to kill them, he was going to eat them, and so on and so forth. And then very quickly it became really apparent to me, and I would think anybody that was really paying attention, that he hadn't done anything, that these were just fantasies, and that you know, there was no real intent. So then when he was actually convicted and sent to prison, I actually tried to get in touch with Gil back then. Like, I tried to get in touch with him through his lawyer back then when he was incarcerated, and didn't have any luck on that. And then when he was exonerated, I reached out through his lawyer, the same lawyer, and she put us in touch. So I've been wanting to work with him on it for a couple of years.
What is your background informs your decision to work on this case, basically on this book, I should say, but also what does your background include? You talked about the ALCU.
I worked for the American Civil Liberties Union as a prisoner advocate, basically. It was called a prison law coordinator position, but I've been ghostwriting, co-authoring for a while. I did not ghostwrite this with Gil. We definitely co-authored it the whole way, but I've been doing some ghostwriting work, and I was also already really interested in prisoner civil rights. And also I'm really interested in people being sort of judged because of having thoughts that don't fit in with the norm,
right.
Which Gil certainly fits into that category.
Yeah,
so
the
whole thing was really interesting to me.
Yeah. There's no denying, you know, that I'm into some weird, deviant things, but the question isn't whether people agree with that or if people like me for that. The question is, did I belong in prison? And anyone who pays attention, anyone who takes the time to read the book will hopefully reach that right conclusion that I did not belong in prison.
Now, just like any book, we are going to have to go back in this story, as you do, to tell us how you grew up, how you got to the point where these fantasies were important enough that you risked certain things in your life and you were discovered. So let's at least find out how you grew up. Everybody wants to know how, again, they have an idea of who you are and how you became that way. But in the book, you tell us how you grew up in Queens, New York. So tell us what your early life was like.
Yeah, extremely normal childhood. My parents separated when I was very young. That was about the only thing that wasn't normal. But I went to Catholic school my whole life. I had no problems making friends. I played baseball. I was basically the all-American kid. When I hit puberty, I started realizing that I was getting aroused by certain things. I would see a TV show or a movie, and I would see scenes of a woman tied up, and that's what aroused me. It's not something I ever volunteered to people. I just didn't want to tell anyone that, you know, it was something I kept to myself. It never affected me at all. I was a honor roll student in high school. I took college courses. I was a dean's list student in college. I mean, none of this stuff ever affected who I was in real life, but it was still something I wanted to keep to myself because I was kind of afraid how people would react. So it was really about the bondage type stuff, seeing a woman tied up and helpless. When I discovered pornography in my 15, 16 years old, I tended to gravitate toward websites that catered to that stuff, women tied up. And I discovered one of these cannibal porn websites in college, and the whole story is told in the book, so I don't want to get into too much detail there, but and, you know, from there, I discovered the Dark Fetish Network. It was a social network with people with similar fantasies could chat and role play about similar things. So that's the Cliff Notes version.
Before we get to all that, though, you talk about this normal upbringing. You talk about having your what would you call it, fixed in terms of just like a gay person doesn't choose these
right.
these images, the things that you fantasized about and the things that turned you on initially, like you say, watching television programs, that you had this idea of the bondage, and so you gravitated towards that. But in your real life, because this, again, this is something you kept secret, this is not something you shared with anyone, especially in the beginning,
yeah.
what was your real life dating life like? You talk about college, you talk about high school, you talk about how shy you were. So tell our audience who you really were, and in real life, how sexual were you?
Not very sexual. I never had problems making friends. I had friends, male friends and female friends. If I liked a girl, I tend to get a little shy and I would clam up a bit. I didn't have sex until I was 25. It was nothing that really preoccupied me that much. I wasn't overly concerned, like, oh my God, I have to have sex before I graduate from college. It just never, you know, I was very focused on school and, you know, doing well and just setting myself up to succeed in life. But I had very normal relationships. After all this happened, after I was arrested, you know, law enforcement went back to basically every woman I ever crossed paths with in my life. It was ridiculous. And 99% of them had nothing but good things to say about me. You know, yeah, Gil was a normal guy. I never felt threatened by him. We were friends. We hung out all the time. And that's who I really was. Just a regular, unassuming, nice guy.
How do you become interested? You're in college. How do you become interested? Because you didn't go into college thinking about law enforcement. How is it that you get influenced to consider law enforcement, and take us from there once you do have this interest?
Sure. I declared psychology early on as a major. After sophomore year, I had an internship in Manhattan in an office building, regular 9-to-5 office job, paid pretty well for a 20-year-old. But the one thing I took from there is that there's no way in hell I wanted to be in an office or sit behind a computer screen for the rest of my life. So when I went back to college, I doubled up on criminal justice and I started taking some classes where I had police officers and retired captains down in Maryland. I went to the University of Maryland. So they made law enforcement sound very interesting, and I started to look at the NYPD, and the benefits they offered were outstanding, you know, the whole thing. And I wanted a career where I could kind of do something new every day. I could be outdoors and I could help people for a living. That's what really drew me to become a police officer. And I loved it, you know, for the most part. 6 years, I passed the sergeant's exam. There were things, of course, I didn't like, but that's any job. I do miss it. I wish I had my old life back, but that ship, unfortunately, has sailed, and here we are.
And you can say you enjoyed being a cop. You were a good cop. You were a cop for the right reasons, and you didn't take advantage of being a cop. You were a good cop.
Yeah, 6 years. I never had one civilian complaint on my record. I never had any disciplinary problems. As I said, I passed a sergeant's exam on the first attempt. I had a very good and rewarding 6 years, and it's something that no one can take from me. I know I was a good cop. I was well respected by my peers, by my supervisors, and by the community. So, you know, like I said, there are things I miss. I miss that career of helping people, you know, for a living. There's no greater calling, I think. You know, but it's something I don't think I can ever do again, unfortunately.
Now, you also talk about relationships that you had, were longstanding relationships that never really evolved into romantic relationships, like Melanie and Kate from Maryland. So tell us first about Melanie and basically what really it entailed, the relationship. What did you would have liked in real life? And then what was your fantasy at that time so that we can understand a little bit of your thought process in real life
and
then the fantasy?
Yeah, first of all, Melanie is not her real name. I there are some names I changed in the book. I just didn't feel like it was appropriate to bring these women back into the whole thing again. You know, they did nothing wrong. They didn't want to be involved in any of this. So I decided to change their names. So, we'll stick with Melanie. But she was the first girl I fell in love with. And everyone remembers the first person they fall in love with. I was 16 years old, and I had it bad for her. You know, she could do no wrong. We would hang out, and she was frustrating. You know, we had a tumultuous back and forth. We would have an argument, and we'd meet up again. And this was like 8-9 years where nothing ever happened. You know, the more mature me would move on like right away. But I don't know. She just always was one of those things, you know, where I always held out hope, but it never happened. And the fantasies I was having were the same fantasies, you know, bondage, domination, and all that kind of stuff. And I centered them around women that I knew in my life. That's where, although my fantasies are unusual and abnormal and deviant, the fact that I centered them around women that I knew is not unusual at all. I think when people have fantasies, they center them around people they know in their real lives. I don't think there's anything abnormal about that aspect.
Right. So you, again, as you talk about, you have these normal relationships. They're platonic. They're your close friends, mind you. But you have a fantasy life that is, can we say, fair? It is evolving. You are now interested in some websites. We talk about Mookie's Kitchen. So just when is it that you again add cannibalism to part of your fantasy?
It was, I think, my sophomore year of college. I was about 20 years old, and I discovered that website, and it was more about the idea of a woman being tied up and, like, in preparation to be cooked. Like, my fantasies never got to the part where, you know, it was actually carving and all the bloody stuff. It never got that far. It was more about the bonded stuff, and I liked the scenario where she'd be, you know, helpless, and like that would be the peak of it.
Yeah,
you know,
part of this
is
well,
pretty. It's one thing to write it in a book and to write about it in an email. It's still pretty difficult to talk about it. Even on the phone, you know what I mean? It's something I'll never get used to. I didn't want any of this stuff out there. This is out there not by my choice, but it's out there. I wrote a book, so I know I have to talk about it, but that doesn't mean that it's easy.
No, sorry.
I was just going to say quickly, I mean, this to me is one of the most interesting aspects of the whole scenario because so many different people have very odd fantasies. Some of them are dark, some of them are scary, some of them are really silly. I mean, there's so many different paraphilias and fetishes that people have, but I mean, Gil's the only person I can think of that was actually, you know, incarcerated for thinking these types of things. So I think even him trying to explain the type of things that he was into, it's if we were all forced to explain the types of things that we were really into, I think we'd all be, most of us or a lot of us anyway, might be a little bit uncomfortable.
Explain that way, I can relate to that. Yes, you're absolutely right. So maybe we'll go ahead, sorry.
No, I was just going to piggyback off that. This isn't three guys, you know, grabbing a beer. This is a show where, you know, people are listening to this, people I don't know. And it's just, anyway, the point's made. It's tough to talk about. So let's keep it moving.
Now, the other part of this is that you, like, very much like a penthouse forum, you know, if you could believe every one of those letters into the editor on penthouse forum, very much of this, you had an interest in the writing, and you're a good writer, obviously, from this book, but also that you write in this book, that you were creative, and you were half of this, or a good portion of this, is the storytelling aspect. So maybe you can tell us about the websites you gravitated towards and really what happened in terms of finding people that you chatted with and were more interested in, say, the regular people that were on this, say, forum or site?
Well, the website Dark Fetish Network, it kind of built itself as a Facebook for people, like a social network for people with unusual fetishes, and it's more about communication, people talking about the things they're into, and then you find they divide those sites into groups, so you get into who's more into bondage and domination, you see the members who are, you know, into that stuff, and you know, some people wrote better than others, so I would chat and communicate with people who, like me, were decent storytellers. And, you know, not to brag about my writing skills, but I got the FBI to believe that I was a real kidnapper. You know, I was going to really kidnap three, you know, women on different continents on the same day. I mean, the FBI actually believed that, as ridiculous as that sounds. But, yeah, so I enjoyed the scenes. They were collaborative role plays. They were fictional stories, but they were detailed. They sounded detailed. They sounded very graphic. And the whole idea, it's like, who can, all right, like, this guy writes pretty well. Let me see if I can outdo him. Can I say something more deviant? And that's how it kind of snowballed. But it never got out of control. Again, it never affected my real life. At this point, I was a police officer. I had just met Kathleen, who ended up becoming my wife, and this stuff never, ever bled into my real life. It never affected my ability to be a father or a husband. It was something I did on the side. It was something that I still kept private. The only people who knew were anonymous screen names on the internet. You know, I never shared my name, where I was from, what I did for a living, and neither did anybody else. We were all just anonymous screen names, and I think that helped with, you know, when you're just a screen name on a computer, you can pretty much say whatever you want and you feel safe and no one's ever going to find out. But when it's Gil Valley, when my name's attached to it now that all has happened, and, you know, I was forced to read a lot of the things that I wrote as part of the trial, and when I read a newspaper article, they always, you know, find some really sick stuff that I wrote, and it's very tough for me to even read that, and I'm the one who wrote it. But just seeing my name next to it, it's a kind of a different element. I don't know if you guys could follow that, but I'm kind of rambling a bit, so I don't know if you want to reel me back
let's
in.
Let's talk about Kathleen, because your marriage indicates a lot of things. It helped to exonerate you in terms, it was fodder for a documentary. Again, I'm sort of rambling a little bit here, but let's talk about Kathleen and the marriage, what you thought at the time. Obviously, you wanted to marry her. How was this relationship? What did it turn into in terms of what did you think this relationship was? And tell us about your life married.
We had a wonderful 3 years together, and I try and hang on to the positive memories, and there were a lot of them. You know, she was the woman she was the love of my life. I married her. We clicked from the first date. There was just chemistry there, and we clicked right off the bat. And it was just a really, really good thing. It was a great 3 years. And unfortunately, it came to this where, you know, I don't want to get too much into what's going on now with family court and our daughter, but we had a very, very good relationship. She got pregnant. It was a surprise. It was not something we planned that soon, but, you know, we made it work. We moved into a very big apartment in Queens, and just life was so good. I was making enough money where she could be a stay-at-home mom, and that's what she wanted to do, and that's what worked for us. You know, she stayed at home with the baby. I worked. I did all the shopping. I never complained about it. It was something I enjoyed. You know, a man is supposed to provide for his family. You know, then the arrest happened, and the trial happened, and there was this whole portrayal out there that I was a deadbeat father, and I didn't care about the family, and that's just that didn't do anything to push a jury to convict me, but as a man with pride, it really hurt to listen to my wife, you know, tell this narrative of what life was like in our home that just was completely untrue. And I think I highlight certain things in the book, and I provide, you know, text messages from when we were married, and anyone who reads those can't conclude that this was an unhappy situation.
Well, let's go back and give her a chance to be fair as well, to see why she might be motivated to do the things that she did. And you do provide that as well by saying, listen, I felt bad for her. And you at least allude to, and the reader can read for themselves, that this was a very, very aggressive prosecution. And obviously, if you're exonerated and somebody was, again, you accuse them of prosecutorial misconduct, and you name this person. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But let's talk about how this happens, because this isn't somebody went online. Needless to say, they told you, the FBI, when they first spoke to you, and let's not get ahead, in that they had been under surveillance for 18 months. But let's, as you do know, and you do write in the book, tell us how this came to be. Your computer was in repair. You shared a computer. What were the sites that you were into at that time, and how was it that Kathleen stumbled on to this, and what was her reaction?
It was the same websites. It was the Dark Fetish Network. That was really what I did when I went on the computer, and when I looked at pornography, that was my go-to. That was what I gravitated towards. So as you mentioned, we shared a computer, and one day I left my account open, and she logged in, and she saw some vanilla bondage website. I don't even know what it was, but it was just like pictures of women tied up, nothing violent, nothing bloody or gory or nothing like the Dark Fetish Network. So she woke me up, and, she was she actually felt bad that she stumbled upon it. Like, she was almost blaming herself. She's like, you know, like, I didn't mean to. I wasn't snooping. It was just there, and I'm sorry. So she was the one feeling bad. I was feeling kind of embarrassed because, as I said earlier, I had never told anyone about my interest in pornography. So I was embarrassed. I was nervous, but we talked it through. I didn't give her the whole thing. I told her, listen, I've been, you know, I'm kind of interested in bondage stuff. And then she came back with, well, let's see if we could spice up our sex life with this. So we talked about maybe going into a sex shop and buying some toys. I never did, because 2 weeks later she installed spyware. She thought I was having an affair because of the time I was spending late at night on the computer, on the internet. So she thought I was having an affair, so she installed spyware, and then that's how she found the Dark Fetish Network and then all the chats and emails, and obviously she was horrified. And I never blamed her for the way she reacted. I mean, just imagine the person you're married to, you find out they're into this really violent stuff and, you know, centering the fantasies around people that you know in your real life. And in my case, I use pictures of her too. I use pictures of Kathleen as part of the story. So yeah, I never faulted her for how she reacted. Her first reaction, despite all of that, was, okay, I'm going to get away for a while, but let's find a couple therapists and work this out. You know, she wasn't giving up on the relationship, or, you know, so I figured, as bad as it was, that was about as good of a reaction as she could possibly have. At some point she went home to Nevada with the baby, and somebody talked her into going to law enforcement, and that's when everything came crashing down. That's where I never faulted her for how everything played out. I faulted the FBI for just being incredibly stupid and dishonest, and, you know, just completely turning her, convincing her that this was a real thing, that she was on the verge of being murdered, when it was so clear that that was the furthest thing from reality. So even today, I haven't spoken to Kathleen since all this happened, and we have family court stuff pending, but some days I get a little upset, and I kind of redirect that anger toward the FBI and the prosecutors and the people who completely turned her, because, again, her initial reaction was, okay, I'm going to get away, but this is something we're going to work out. And, you know, once law enforcement got involved and these absolute corrupt criminals, these stupid morons, you know, once they got involved, that was it. You know, everything was over.
Now, Brian, I wanted to ask you, you talked when I first asked you that you initially tried to reach out to Gil right away when you heard about this. Now, with your background, what did you see initially, even though the press was, again, very tabloid-esque and running with this cannibal cop, so very lurid, tabloid-esque kind of coverage, it seemed. What did you see initially, and what did you see with him being denied bail, which is quite unusual for anything outside of murder, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, initially, all the press coverage was completely one-sided, like, the first few days. And so, like, at that moment, I think everybody thought guilty, because it was just, they were just going at that point off of what the FBI gave the press. But even when the press started coming out after a few weeks, I mean, the fact that he was on a fetish site, and I know that to a lot of people that probably doesn't mean a whole lot, but, you know, well, what does that matter if he's saying these types of things? I mean, the place that he was actually talking to these other people was a fantasy site. He wasn't, like, on some sort of secret guerrilla dark web place where he was plotting with these people. It was a very – that's what it was for. It was for people to have fantasies, to talk to people about their fantasies. And it just was – it was just fairly obvious to me and a lot of other people that I knew – because a lot of people I knew were talking about the case. A lot of people were talking about the case all over the world, that it just didn't seem right. It just didn't seem right that this maniac police officer was planning on kidnapping and eating all these women. And then, obviously, Gil already alluded to this, but then when any sort of facts started coming out, it was like, you know, oh, he was going to take them in his white van to this mountain house, and these places didn't even exist. I mean, the farther it went, the more it was just amazing that he even was being prosecuted at all, to me.
Dan, I was told by a couple of journalists, Aaron, one of you, you mentioned Aaron Carr, the person who did the documentary. She was one of the people who told me if you were to black out the names of the court transcripts, you black out the names from the bail hearings and then the actual trial, you would think it's two completely different cases, because as Brian just said, early on, there were things presented that just weren't true. And the trial happened, and it's like, okay, so where is this, you know, this GPS evidence that I was actually stalking someone in real life? That never happened. Of course, you know, there was no evidence because that stuff never happened. So, you know, Danny mentioned I was being denied bail, and that was unusual. And I was denied bail really based on these lies that were being told in court. And eventually the facts come out. We get all the discovery turned over, and it's like, so what, you know, like nothing happens. The judge was lied to, you know, he sat there through bail hearings and he was lied to by these people, and nothing happens. It's like, okay, that's business as usual, so deal with it. Meanwhile, I'm denied bail, I'm in solitary confinement, and it's like, so what? You know, I never blamed the media coverage. I did read a lot of it when I was eventually released from prison. And, you know, people think I hate the media. They're like, no, the media was reporting what was being said in court. What was being said in court was that, you know, I had names and addresses of women on my computer. That never happened. They were reporting that I had actually exchanged personal information with people. That never happened. And, you know, this thing with the, they had GPS evidence that was on a woman's block. That never happened either. So I understand how people reacted early on, but it was based on a lot of misinformation, and that misinformation is still, even to this day, out there, which is why I was pushed to write the book, because I finally wanted my side out there. you know, and everything I say in this book is backed up on court transcripts. I shared as much as I possibly could, even really embarrassing stuff. You know, again, it's one thing to write about it. It's okay to put it on paper, but to talk about it, as I said before, is still pretty difficult, but, you know, got to do
now,
it.
Now, Brian, there, we've got to get to, I mean, you do the outline, like you say, there's certain things. There was a surveillance claim that was unfounded that they used in the bail hearing to deny you bail more than once. The cell phone
yes.
tower technology where they said they could pinpoint it, you were on a street, then later it was 5 football fields away. So
yeah.
there, and we will talk about your solitary confinement, but let's talk about, Brian, what you saw. Again, you know the difference between these fantasy sites, but the government did have something. The prosecution did have something enough to convict someone. So what did they use? What was their, again, what evidence did they, their theory was based on, tell us what their theory was based on. What did they go on to be able to say, to qualify to say that he was going to kidnap these women with a co-conspirator and this mountain house? So explain this van, mountain house, this whole theory that the FBI has.
I mean, Gil might be able to explain that better. I mean, to me, it's just based on, it's a jury trial and it's based on mass hysteria. I mean, it's just you're sitting there, he's sitting there, you're saying all these horrible things that he's planning, so they must be true. I mean, there's no way that this could happen unless this person was actually doing some of those things. I mean, I can't think of any real evidence that they had. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me at all that he was convicted. And Gil, I mean, maybe you could speak to that better, because I mean,
yeah,
as someone on the outside, he was there. I mean, as someone on the outside, when I'm reading, you know, the facts, not just what I've gotten through Gil, but just the facts in general, I mean, there's really, it's a very rare thing for a man to be exonerated, as Gil was. So the exoneration was proof in itself that they didn't have any real evidence on them.
There was absolutely no real evidence. The main piece of evidence were the chats and emails, and the chats and emails were replete with fictional information. We talked about the mountain house in the middle of nowhere, a white van, a human-sized oven, all this stuff that never existed. But I was a police officer. I had a gun and handcuffs, and I never mentioned those in the chats because, again, that was a fictional character. I didn't share who I really was, and neither did anyone I was chatting with. So they took 24 sets of communications, me and 24 different people. They determined that 21 of the sets of chats were fantasy, but 3 were real plans. If you look at, and the judge highlighted this beautifully when he acquitted me and in his written ruling, the chats have the same exact information in them. They have the same exact lies, the same exact plots, everything virtually identical, plus the quote-unquote real chats had a plot, and the FBI said this was a serious thing. On February 20th, I was going to kidnap a woman in Manhattan. I was going to kidnap one in Ohio, and I was going to another one to Pakistan, all on the same day. And this is a trial, and they're saying that this is a real thing. I mean, we had people in the jury laughing, people in the audience laughing when that was revealed. But somehow I was still convicted. And I think, you know, Dan, you mentioned earlier the prosecutorial misconduct. The closing argument was just full of just disgusting. I mean, you know, it basically, number one, I didn't testify because their case ended up being so weak. I was like, what good is it going to do for me to testify? They're just going to hammer home all the chats again, you know, read all these chats and emails. We had already gone through that, so why go up there and live that again? They used that against me. They said in the closing argument, you know, you have to factor in that you heard nothing from the defense as to, you know, you heard no explanation why he's doing this. So that's not allowed. That's against my constitutional right not to testify. There's also this theme of basically, thank God they caught him when he did, because he might do something in the future. That's not what a trial is. The trial is based on what I already did in the past, not on what I might do in the future. Just hammering home, you know, just always mentioning that this is a police officer with a gun, this is a police officer with a gun, just over and over and over again. All the analogies they use, you know, they compared my case to an airplane hijacking, a bank robbery, just a whole bunch of stuff that the judge acquitted me based on lack of evidence. Okay, he said there's no evidence to support the guilty verdict, so the ruling stops here. But he did feel compelled to mention the misconduct because it was so rampant and so egregious that toward the end of his ruling, he did say, you know, I do feel compelled to mention the trial tactics of the prosecution were not exactly on the level here. So that's what got the jury to convict. But thank God the judge had the wisdom and courage to do the right thing and set that verdict aside. And as Brian mentioned earlier, the way I was acquitted just never happens for a trial judge to not only set the verdict aside, but dismiss the charge too. Normally a person would get a new trial. But he said, no new trial. The case is dismissed. So that never happens. That just shows what a travesty this prosecution was.
Now, let's talk about what's really important, and you are suing the government as you've been recommended, but part of this book, very powerful part of this book, is a police officer going to prison. So
yeah.
Why do you choose solitary confinement for those people that might not be able to figure it out? And tell us just a little about this ordeal for you.
Well, I was placed in solitary confinement for my protection. I was a police officer, so the prison was afraid that if I was in the general population, it was a safety issue because I was a cop and I was with a bunch of prisoners. So they put me in solitary confinement. I was by myself. No one to talk to. I couldn't make phone calls. I couldn't see my family. The only people I saw were my lawyers when they came. There's supposed to be paperwork for visitation for my family, and that stuff never worked out. It just always got lost, or there was something fishy going on. I don't really mention it in the book because the prison guards, for the most part, were very much in my corner, and they took care of me. They made sure I was all right, but the solitary confinement was a nightmare. And there were days where I'd wake up and I'd have a dream, right? I had a dream where I was with Kathleen and my daughter. I have a dream where I was back in a patrol car, and then to wake up in that cold, dirty, filthy cell, those were the hardest days. No human contact at all for 7 months. Finally, after 7 months, they gave me a chance in general population. But just a range of emotions on a daily basis. You go from anger to fear to worrying about my family, my mom and dad, my brother, what are they dealing with on the outside? I'm relatively shielded. I'm hidden from everything, but my family is on the outside dealing with neighbors, coworkers, and again, I had no way to talk to them, so I had no idea how they were handling everything. So add that to it. Add my Kathleen, who I hadn't realized how much she was involved in the prosecution at that time. I was worried about her, my daughter, the case. And then getting angry at the prosecutors who were lying. I know they're lying, but there's no one I can tell. There's no one who would listen to me at that point. So it was tough, and I still deal with issues today. I can't sleep with my bedroom door closed because it makes me feel confined. It's just one of those things. Hopefully I can get over that one day, but right now I can't. I still have nightmares where, I have nightmares where I'm back in prison, where I'm back in a cell, and I wake up sweating and panting, and it takes me a minute to realize that I'm home. I'm in my own bed, and it's over. So I'm acquitted and I'm exonerated, but there's still a lot of things I deal with. There's no getting rid of this at all. So yeah, you're goddamn right, I'm suing the government.
And you do have, you filed the complaint for prosecutorial misconduct.
That's being worked on right now. I still have, you see, there's simultaneous things going on, and I can't, so I have a lawsuit in against the feds right now. I'm waiting to hear back on that. I have a lawyer for that. I have a guy who, on a contingency, felt it was important enough to help me. So, you know, thank God for him. But while that's playing out, I'm also working on the complaint, as you said, the judicial misconduct against the main prosecutor in the case, who just blatantly lied about many things. And, you know, those were the main reasons I was denied bail. And I just think it's right to file a formal complaint, because I don't think she should get away. I don't think that woman should be within 100 yards of a courtroom, to be honest, because I don't want what she did to me to happen to somebody else.
Right. Now, you talk about the trial. We won't go into all of it. We'll leave it for the person to discover, the reader. But obviously, Kathleen, Kate, other people testify. Let's talk about Kathleen and her testimony, what your reaction, impression was, and how supportive was your family? Was your family behind you through this entire thing?
My family never believed any of the charges from the first day. They were behind me from day one. They didn't believe a second of it. So they were at every court appearance. They were at every bail hearing. They were at everything. They were there. My mom and dad sitting together like they were married. I mean, that was kind of weird to see. But they never, for a second, never one second did they believe that this could have possibly happened. So, no, I mean, they were completely supportive. Kathleen, she took the stand the first day of the trial, and that was the first time I'd seen her since she left. So the trial started in late February, and she left September 12th, so that was 5 months or whatever. I can't do it. September to February, I hadn't seen her. So there she is, first time I'm seeing her, and she's the star witness. She's the first witness for the prosecutors, and I wasn't prepared for that. I was expecting her to just talk about what she found and how she found it. I wasn't expecting to be absolutely bulldozed by a narrative of what life was like in our home that was completely false. You know, so she made me out to be completely incompetent as a father, someone who was disinterested in the family. And again, that didn't really, you know, I can be a piece of garbage father and still be not guilty of the crime I was being charged with. But to sit there and listen to that stuff was extremely difficult. When me and her both know it's not true. So it was just, it was a wave of emotions. You know, seeing her was tough. It was my actions that led to all this. You know, it was me taking part in these role plays that put us in that situation. But then again, it wasn't a crime. So, you know, just going back and forth, and then, I mean, both of us were crying hysterically through the whole thing, and the judge had to grant us, like, several recesses because we just were both, so we both couldn't compose ourselves, and it was just, I don't know if that was the toughest part of the trial. I mean, the most embarrassing part of the trial were the 2 days or so where they just read line after line, you know, every goddamn thing I wrote in that website was read for like 2 straight days. So that was, I mean, I wouldn't wish that level of embarrassment on my worst enemy, but I think emotionally the toughest part was Kathleen's testimony.
Now tell us what Julia's, and you have a really good defender here. She's very passionate about your case. Was this a public defender? And tell us if it was. And this Julia and her team that were employed to represent you, tell us a little bit about their strategy and this defense team.
Yeah, Julia Gatto, she was a public defender, and she was on duty that day. So thank God they arrested me that day, not the next day. I would have ended up with somebody else. But, yeah, she's a public offender, no money, you know, no charge. The police union never showed up, which I have a big problem with now that this is all over. I have a major, major problem with how the police union handled everything. But we can get there later. Julia, from the first day I met her, she didn't believe any of she got it right away. She said, like, these are really serious allegations, but I get that it's a game. It's like she kept comparing it to Dungeons and Dragons. You know, it's a role-playing game. She understood it, and I saw her arguing at first bail hearing, and I said, you know what, I'm going to be completely fine with her because she was, you said the word passionate. She was aggressive. She was defending me aggressively despite the horrific and graphic allegations, and I thought that it also helped that she was a female. You know, this was a case depicting fictional violence against women, and I had a woman defending me. So
right.
I thought that was a big help too. But, you know, there wasn't much strategy early on because we didn't have any evidence turned over yet. The prosecutors were spewing their nonsense at the bail hearings, and I was scribbling stuff down like, okay, she's, you know, the prosecutor's saying this, here's where I really was, here's what really happened. And Julia would, you know, tell my side, but we had nothing to back it up, so the judge is going to believe the prosecutors. Eventually, when we got all the evidence turned over, Julia had, like, a new fire lit under her because she realized that, like, everything I said was the truth. And I think she believed me, you know, early on, but in the back of her mind, she had to be thinking, well, there's got to be something because what is he, you know, why is he arrested? Why is he here? There has to be something. But months later, when finally all my bail chances were over, you know, I had no more chance at bail. The prosecutors then turned everything over and, you know, surprise, it was all nonsense. So Julia was, I mean, she was angry. You know, she actually said that prosecutor belongs in prison. And, you know, I don't want to speak for her, but apparently they don't talk anymore, those two. And I guess it's because of my case and how dishonest they were.
Now, you talked about the police union not backing you up, and you say your family did, so this has got to be the most trying and challenging time of your life, this 21 months. Tell us, as you do, it's interesting why you decided to go into general population. There are some risks. Obviously, that's why you were in solitary confinement. So tell us what happens in reality, a little bit of good news for you in there.
Yeah, well, I mean, it reached a point where I just couldn't take being alone anymore, so I requested a meeting with some of the prison officials, and they were against it. I basically begged them to give me a chance. I said, I don't care if I get my ass kicked the first day. So they were hesitant, but they finally, you know, they gave me a shot. So they sent me to one of the housing units, and everyone knew who I was. It was pretty clear. It was a high-profile case. They get newspapers in prison, so our, you know, everyone followed the case in the papers, and they all knew who I was. There was no hiding it. So my strategy was to just keep to myself, mind my own business, don't talk to anybody, just, you know. They had TVs there. I hadn't watched TV in 8 months. So there was a Yankee game on. I love baseball, so I got a chair out of my cell, and I sat in front of the TV and watched a Yankee game for the first time in forever. And you know, the first couple of days were pretty much I was kind of by myself, and then I was reading a book, sitting on one of the tables, and another inmate sat next to me. He was having lunch, and out of nowhere he goes, keep fighting, you're gonna win. So that was the first time someone really talked to me, and he kind of hinted that, yeah, you know, everybody here knows who you are, but everybody thinks the case is total bullshit, and you know, they don't believe any of the charges or whatever. So I think it was interesting. I think he must have been nominated somehow. Maybe he drew the short straw, like they must have been like, all right, somebody's got to talk to this guy to see what he's really like. And it was him. And then he probably went back and told everyone, like, guys, he's completely normal. And then after that, more and more people started to talk to me. And You know, no one ever got in my face. No one was ever mean or violent. Or, of course, I never let my guard down, but I was able to survive there. And it was tough because I had been convicted, and we had paperwork in to try and correct the injustice, but we didn't know when the judge was going to rule. You know, so there was no date to look forward to. My dogs are acting. I'm sorry. there was just no end in sight. It was like today might be the day, or it might be tomorrow, or it might be 2 months from now. But while I was in general population, I had people there who were, they could tell when I was having an especially bad day. You know, there were days that were harder than others. Father's Day was impossible. My daughter's birthday was, you know, just, I don't even want to talk about that. Eventually, I ended up getting a job, too, to help pass more time. I ended up working in the kitchen. I know that was the subject of a lot of jokes. I was back on the front page of the Daily News because they found out that I worked in the kitchen. And, you know, that became a big circus. But it helped pass the time. So, again, nobody, as a former police officer, no one ever got in my face. And that was something that, like, I relied on the support I had from inmates, you know. The police union, the cops were silent, but I had support from inmates in prison. Go figure.
Interesting. You talk about, and I'll ask this for Brian, what did you think of when you were involved with the writing of this book, the information that was provided in the trial with this six-month-old agent? Well, I'm not 6 months old, but 6 months as an agent, an FBI agent, this Walsh guy. What'd you think of that?
Right. Well, I mean, it's as I said before, it's really amazing to me. I'm going to say almost the same thing, but it's amazing to me that it even reached a level of prosecution. There was just the agent in particular in the testimony there, he just was not giving anything that, you know, that was valid, that one would consider to be criminal activity. You know, so, I mean, I don't know what else to state about it other than that.
Yeah.
He was,
well, it's just, it was funny as Gil writes in the book, as you write in the book, how.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, sorry. What I found humorous was the cross-examination of this agent Walsh, supposed to be a kidnapping expert. He was there. I mean, they brought him in. The prosecution can be prepared or not prepared to put forward their case. As you say, a couple big breaks you had, and then you have this agent Walsh, and it's laughable. People are laughing at the trial over the cross-examination. You think your prosecution is vigorous. They make a lot of inroads, and you figure we're not going to have you testify, which they thought they might have to do that. So tell us about how devastating was this to lose when you thought, I guess in your mind, it was, I'm ready to get out of here. What
was
that
we
like?
Thought we were home. That cross-examination was the turning point of the trial, we thought. You know, that was I was home free after that. There was no way a jury was going to convict. It was during that cross-examination that whole thing with February 28th and kidnapping three women on three different continents came out. So, as you said, people were laughing, and the judge even had this smirk on his face. And the courtroom was packed every day. There was standing room only. It was a huge courtroom. And there were a lot of media there, and Julia, my lawyer, had, you know, relationships with some of the people in the press. And after that cross-examination, during the next break, people in the media were telling her, "You guys got it. This case is a joke." There were articles written the next day. You know, the tabloids who had hammered me from the beginning were now saying. Well, I remember one line in one of the papers was something like, "Did you hear that sound? That's the sound of the government's case flushing down the toilet." Because, like, this case is a complete joke. And they made the point that I made earlier, you know, that doesn't mean that people have to like me or people have to be my friend or whatever. the question is, did I belong in prison? That's the only thing I care about. People who read this book, they're going
right.
to be – there are parts in this book that are going to make people uncomfortable because I'm so – you know, I share a lot of really graphic stuff about my fantasies. And the thought process behind that is like, I want the people who hate me the most to still conclude that I didn't belong in prison. But back
even,
to the trial, I'm sorry, who was
oh,
talking?
No, sorry. I was just going to say real quick, Gil, but even now when we get – I appreciate that you've actually read the book, Dan, and that you're asking that you're asking really relevant questions, because even now so much of the press that we get, and we have had a lot of good press, all the people want to talk about even now are Gil's fantasy. I mean, it doesn't even – it's very rare that someone will even talk about – whether they're criminal or not, or it's almost always just about the actual fantasy. It's like that's where people get stuck. It's just like they stay right there and like and just want to go there and never want to talk about the fact that a man literally spent almost 2 years of his life in prison and didn't do anything. You know, it's mind-blowing
right.
to me.
Yeah, so going back to the trial, you know, that was a turning point. We felt good. The government rested their case shortly after that. Our defense was pretty quick. It was over in a day. We had the guy, the founder of that website, testify that, there are like a ton of people into cannibal fantasies. You know, like a lot of people on the website are there. 75,000, 80,000 members of that website, which, you know, no one else is being prosecuted except me. We had our paralegal. I mean, it was a really boring defense. Nothing, I don't want to go too much into it. There was nothing substantial. Either way, it was just really quick and over in a day. And then they got to the closing arguments, and I touched on before, their closing argument was just completely improper, and Julia got it all back with a really great closing argument. We felt really good. The jury came back after 3 days, and I heard that guilty word, and it was just utter, complete shock and devastation. I mean, I was already rehearsing what I was going to say to the press. You know, what, I was like, all right, I'm going home today. I'm going to go and see my dog, you know, my dog who I missed, my little bulldog Dudley. I was going to go play with my dog, and I was going to have a home-cooked meal and catch up with everybody. And then just to hear guilty, and, you know, that crime carried a possible life sentence, so I was facing life in prison after that. I wasn't thinking about appeals or anything. I was just, like, shaking. I was shaking. Julia took my hand under the table as the verdict was being read, and you know, after a guilty verdict came, she took my hand, and she just, like, squeezed my hand under the table, and they said there was a loud gasp in the courtroom. I didn't even hear it because I was so shocked, but, I mean, like 20 people told me that when the jury said guilty, people were, like, completely shocked. So over the next couple of days, I got some of that feedback. Julia actually told me that people from the U.S. Attorney's Office were calling her office and basically apologizing, off the record, of course. But, you know, that told me that maybe by some miracle there are honest people who work in that absolute cesspool of an office. For prosecutors to be calling my lawyer and apologizing, you know, and Julia was getting emails from lawyers all over the country. So, I mean, the shock and devastation wore off pretty quickly, and I kind of refocused on the appeal. And with all this feedback we were getting, I thought the chances were good. We all thought the chances were good at getting a new trial. If not for the lack of evidence, just based on the closing argument alone. I mean, that was reason enough to give a new trial. But the judge took the extra step, thank God, and dismissed the case, and then the Court of Appeals upheld that. But it was a long, you know, talking about it now for 5 minutes is a lot different than living it for 21 months.
You capture that moment, too, where you really didn't know what was going on. You waited the entire day, the June 31st or June 30th. And so you were waiting. You got phone calls up to 9:30. You had, because you're in general population, you were able to send emails up to a certain time. Tell us about that day and what you thought may happen that day and what did actually you And how did you find out the next day, and what did you find out?
Yeah, so just to back up, it was a regular day. I went to work at the kitchen, my, 6 in the morning to noon shift. I came back, as I did every day after work. I went to the computer and checked my emails, and I saw an email from Julia. And again, this is completely out of nowhere. We didn't have a date to look forward to as to when the judge is going to rule. But finally, there's an email from Julia that she got word that the ruling was coming down today. So I'm like, holy crap, it's going to happen today. I'm really nervous. So I close the computer. I call her up on the phone, and we found out that Julia told me that the judge had requested pretrial services to be at a hearing the next morning. Now, pretrial services is someone, they're a unit that recommends whether or not a person gets bail. So they actually, during the initial bail hearings, pretrial services actually recommend that I get bail. And a judge, 9 times out of 10, agrees with pretrial services. I was the one that the judge didn't agree and denied me bail. Anyway, so we were feeling that, okay, so that has to mean that tomorrow's a bail hearing and I'm getting a new trial, right? And we all kind of were feeling that. We were feeling advised. I mean, a new trial would have been a huge victory.
Right.
So the whole day, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3, still no ruling. Then we get into the evening hours and still nothing. It's like 7 o'clock, and Julia said they're staying at the office all night till they get word. But for me, everything shuts down at 9:30. Computers, emails, and we're locked into our cells for the rest of the night. So I gave her one final check at like 9:25. They said they asked the judges, they called the judges' chambers. They said, please, we have a client in prison who's waiting. Can you give us anything? They said, no, not yet. So it was a sleepless night, to say the least. The ruling finally came down around 11 o'clock that night. And everybody knew that I was acquitted except me. I was still in the cell. I had no freaking clue. My family all knew. Everybody knew. I didn't know until 6 o'clock the next morning when they unlocked the cell. And I checked my email, and, I had like 9 emails from Julia and my family and, a couple of people in the media who I was starting to talk to. And that's when I found out that, no, it wasn't a new trial. I was, the judge acquitted me. So I was going home. It was like suddenly, I didn't want to make a huge scene because I'm with a bunch of inmates. So like on the one sense, I'm ecstatic and I want to scream, but I also don't want to make a big scene in front of everybody. So I said a couple of goodbyes. I woke this one guy was sleeping, this guy who I'd become friends with. I went into his cell. I was like, I tapped him on the shoulder. I was like, hey, I'm going home. I got acquitted. And he's like, oh, nice. Went back to sleep. He didn't, it was like that. Like he was half asleep and I didn't make a big deal out of it. And then, before he knew it, I was back in court and I was released. And this sounds really weird, but I almost wish I had just a day that I could have said goodbye to the people there who were so supportive of me, people who helped get me through every day. But everything was so unusual about this case, and even the way I was acquitted was unusual. So that was it. But the funny part was that I was like tossing and turning in a cell while everybody already knew that I was going home.
You talk and you describe that feeling, must have been ecstatic to get out. Your parents met you. You hugged your defense team.
Yeah.
Must have been an intense moment for you, obviously.
Sure. Just a whole range of emotions, And I remember going into the courtroom and just the look of stunned disbelief, at the other table, the prosecutors, and just the excitement at our table. And the hearing started, and the judge said, as I'm acquitting Valley, the charge is dismissed, and blah, 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 blah. And the government said they were going to appeal, so they appealed. So really, like, I was out, but the case was still pending. The government had a right to appeal. And the Court of Appeals could have theoretically reinstated the guilty verdict, and then I would have ended up back in prison. So we felt pretty good. The judge made such a good ruling, 118 pages, and just spelled it out completely as to why no rational juror could reach a guilty verdict. And so we felt pretty good, but there was always that doubt that, you know, I could theoretically one day end up back in prison. So that was tough to deal with a little bit, but in the end, we won everything. So now I'm completely exonerated, completely free. It's never going back to court. It's over. Like, I can close the book on that. But like I said earlier, I'm still dealing with a lot of issues. It's not like, you know, life goes on happily ever after. It's far from it, in fact.
Brian, I wanted to ask you what this process was like. What really your role in this was primarily, other than, I mean, it's a co-author, but tell us a little bit more about your role in this and your experience writing this with Gil.
Sure. Yeah. First of all, I always, every time Gil talks, I always think about how brave Gil is, and he's an extremely brave guy. So right when we first, as Gil said, we did click right away. We've hung out more than a couple times, like, since, you know, socially, even since the situation. We enjoy each other. We get each other. But he's a very, very brave guy, and he's also a very good writer. So, to be honest, it was much easier. I mean, he was much easier than I thought it was going to be. Sometimes when you get into these types of situations, you don't really know, as a writer, you don't really know what you're getting yourself into. And so he was more than open to writing and talking about anything. Initially, kind of what we did was I would probe different areas, ask him different questions. He would write a big section, then I would write a section, and we kind of got through it like that. And then when we got to the court aspect, pretty much almost everything post-arrest is almost just him. And what I did was just kind of like firm it up, move things around a bit. But I mean, he was great to work with. I mean, it was a very good process. I know you said in an email that you liked the book, and I appreciate that. A lot of people have liked the book. It's really getting a lot of positive response. And when you have a situation where you're writing a book with somebody that was arrested for really, really dark fetishes and fantasies, I think it's just a testament to the job that Gil did, with my help, but the job that we did, that people like it as much as they do. So it was a great experience. I've really enjoyed working with Gil.
It was originally going to be a ghostwriter situation where Brian was going to write the book in my voice, but he gave me a shot, and you know, he described early on the process where he would ask a bunch of questions and I would give answers, and he would craft that into a chapter. And I was just, it blew my mind how much it sounded exactly like me. So later on, I took a stab at one of the chapters, like sometime when I was arrested. So I emailed it to Brian. He's like, dude, this is really good. Keep going. So I wrote the next chapter. And again, it's like, don't stop, man. Just keep going, keep rolling with it. And I ended up writing the rest of the book, and he, you know, did the all the fine tuning with grammar and punctuation and all that stuff. I mean, I was pretty good with a lot of it, but he definitely helped me up.
Gil wrote 80% of the book, without a doubt, maybe even 85. You know, and I basically was just you know, making it better. I mean, but it's still mostly Gil. And like I said, I mean, I think you've done some writing, Dan, but a lot of times you get into a situation and you're just like, oh my God, like, what did I get myself into? It was the exact opposite with Gil. It was just, we started writing this, believe it or not, in July, and like and we even had a period where we slowed down because we had a literary agent at one point, and we were going through a process of tweaking it and fine tuning it. And that didn't end up working out for a variety of reasons, but regardless, and we even slowed down. I mean, the actual time that we probably wrote the book was probably about I don't know, man. It was probably like 3 months, you know.
I mean, well, maybe that. Maybe
yeah,
even
maybe
less,
not
yeah,
even
this,
that long, yeah.
It's amazing how quick it went. I mean, that was the other thing I'm glad Brian brought up. I definitely wanted to mention how quick this is. I mean, this is like lightning quick from the moment we when I got Brian's email to the date of the release. It was like 7 months.
8 months,
or something
7 months,
like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something like that, yeah. Which is, you know, I mean, it's almost unheard of, yeah. It's crazy.
Yeah.
That's very, very quick. The other thing you touch in this book, Gil and Brian, is while you were awaiting this decision from the courts, you thought, again, just very much like this book, it's good and essential that you want the story to come out, the real story. And tell us a little bit about a couple people. You had Daniel Engber, basically, was
Engber,
on your side, and you corresponded with him. And also Aaron Lee Carr, the director of Cannibal Cop. So tell us briefly what that was, what you attempted to do, and why you decided to do a documentary, and what you thought of that end result in that documentary.
So Dan Engber is a columnist at Slate Magazine, and as far as I know, he was the first person to publicly challenge what was going on. As we talked about earlier, the narrative was so one-sided, but he was the first one to kind of publicly question what did he actually do here, what really happened. So my lawyer sent me that article when I was in solitary confinement, and that, you know, obviously made me feel pretty good. So he ended up writing to me directly at some point after the conviction, and once I got the general population, I got his email address, and we started communicating through email. And he was one guy who I trusted. He was, like, publicly in my corner, and he was really disgusted with the trial and really was upset with the verdict. So one day we're emailing, and he mentioned Aaron Lee Carr, who is a documentary filmmaker, and she was also extremely upset with the trial, and she was disappointed that I was in prison and I should never have been convicted. So he said that she wanted to talk to me, and she was interested in doing a documentary for HBO. This was still when I was in prison. We had the paperwork in, you know, for the judge to overturn a verdict, and I thought, well, hell, you know, let's put some pressure on the judge, on the court system. This girl wants to do a documentary about how I'm innocent. She's going to question the prosecution here. Like, let's do it. So we communicated through email. My lawyers weren't really thrilled about it, but Aaron spoke with my lawyers too, and they seemed to acknowledge at least that she seems different. She seems like she gets it. We think she'll do a good job. While Aaron and I were talking, she even visited me in prison with my family when my visits finally happened. She would come and visit with my family, and I just completely trusted her. She seemed to really get it. She was in my corner. She was like, I believe in your exoneration and all that stuff. She said all the right things. I mean, how could you not want to work with this girl? Furthermore, her father was a prominent New York Times journalist, David Carr. He written a book, and my brother ordered the book for me. It was called Night of the Gun. So I read that when I was in prison, and it was a story of a man who was just completely a wreck. He had actually, he was arrested 10 or 11 times. He had actually beaten women. He was a severe drug addict, and he was in and out of the system. And finally he got help and turned his life around. And now he was just well-respected and loved by everybody. This journalist to people, like, this is real human story of redemption. So I kind of paralleled my situation with that. So when I get out of prison, I want to be like this guy. I want to rebuild my life better. And so that further pushed me, you know, here's this girl, her father lived through this situation. So surely, I mean, she gets what's going on here better than anybody. It was during the time that I was talking to Aaron that the judge acquitted me. So, then things really moved forward with the documentary. You know, HBO was at my house a couple times a week just filming and talking and, you know, getting a piece of what life was like. And, you know, for me, while the case was still pending and My lawyers turned over a whole bunch of documents to her. There were letters written by the prosecutors to the judge. As part of my bail hearings, you know, these letters that said Valley exchanged real personal information over the internet, all that stuff that wasn't true. And Erin was like flabbergasted by all this. She was like, oh my God, this is such an injustice. And she said, I mean, all I wanted was an accurate representation of what happened. She promised me that. And I was really excited about the documentary, and eventually it came out, and I saw a special screening with my lawyers a week before the premiere. It premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival, which is like a huge deal. And I was supposed to go. I had, you know, they gave me 10 tickets, me, family, friends, and we were all going to go. But I saw a pre-screening, and I was like just completely railroaded and completely disappointed by it. The documentary was basically did what the government did, where they cherry pick things, and you know, the case for the judge to do what he did, it had to be 100% in my favor to, you know, 0%. But Erin made it 50-50, where, and she said that these are her own words, after the thing aired at Tribeca, she was doing a lot of interviews, and all of a sudden the narrative from Erin was she wanted to do a documentary where half the people would walk out of there saying, I think Gil would have done something, and the other half would say, I don't think he would have done something, and that's not at all what I signed up for. It wouldn't make sense for me to sign up for that with the case still pending.
Right.
So she was just, she played me. She played me, my family, my lawyers, and I didn't appreciate that. And to compound it, she was like spewing all this crap to the media. And it was just a really bad situation. It was like I was afraid to show my face in public again. You know, I was in a good spot. I was dating a girl. These things were finally picking up for me again. And I just completely shut down for about a month after that thing came out. It was just such a shock to the system and just a complete disappointment. And she got all this praise. People were like, oh my God, she got the Cannibal Cop. How did she do it? How did she get to participate? And I mean, she got my participation by selling me a completely false bill of goods. And I wanted to make sure that I told part of that story in the book. I mean, she has no integrity at all. And HBO has even less integrity for knowing what she did and then continuing to hire her to do more projects. I have just a major problem with that.
What has been the response? Tell us when this book came out and what has been the response from people that you care about with this book?
Well, not many people from my family have read it because it's going to take them back to those really bad days. You know, so I understand that. My mother read it. My mother's probably the strongest person in my family. She was kind of the face of our family when all this was going on. So she read it, and she even said, like, her heart was pounding, like, out of her chest when she was reading about my time in prison. And, you know, I don't think I was ever completely forthright and honest with them about how tough it was in prison, and I don't think they were ever honest with me about how tough it was on the outside while all this was going on. So it's kind of something we haven't talked about, but the book, you know, I talk in the book how tough it was. So it was very difficult for my mom to get through that stuff, but she read it and she loved it. And I've had friends who, you know, acquaintances who I knew in high school who I didn't really talk to much after I graduated. They've reached out to me on social media, like, you know, I'm sorry this happened, and they love the book. And it just, people are so happy that my side of the story is finally out there. And as far as like strangers and people just leaving reviews on Amazon, I was a little worried that the book was too graphic and people were going to be completely put off by, you know, the prologue, for instance, is very graphic, and it's one of the fantasy scenes, and it's very detailed, and it was something that I was a little concerned that people might not be able to get past that stuff and just kind of shut down and, you know, want to curse me out and things like that. But the response has been overwhelmingly positive from people who have read the book, and that's something that just makes me so happy as an author, where people say it's gripping and they couldn't put the book down, but it's also an easy read. And that's something I wanted to do. You know, I didn't want a complicated book. I wanted something people could read fairly easily. As far as the writing style, I mean, again, there's very graphic stuff, challenging for some people to get through, I'm sure, but they get through it and they reach the right conclusion. So far, I'm just very happy with how it's worked out, and I have no regrets at all in doing this. I know it's kind of bringing everything back to life again, but I'm at a point now mentally where I kind of have no choice. I have to learn to live with this. In a sense, sort of embrace it, and it's just part of me now. This whole Cannibal Cop thing is something I'm never going to shake, so rather than hide from it, I've just learned to live with it and, you know, laugh about it when I can, and, you know, not that everything is always I'm okay with people joking around, because I'd rather people make fun of me and joke around than be afraid, but there's a part of this case that's just so heartbreaking. There's a 5-year-old girl out there, my daughter, who has no idea who her father is. And my family has been completely shut out of her life too. And they did nothing at all to deserve that. And that's the real heartbreaking part of the case that after reading the book, people are finally starting to get to, you know, where I'm not some punchline, you know, I'm a human being too. I'm a father. And, That's been a welcome response, where people have left a review on Amazon where, like, they're talking to me directly and they're saying, I hope you reunite with your daughter soon. And that's just so touching and emotional. It just feels good that after all this time, people are finally, you know, getting it.
This must be a feather in your cap as well, Brian, to do an important book with an important subject. And do you think this is going to be, again, one of those cases that they're going to reference, and this book, as an example of that, will be part of that reference?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it definitely was. It was definitely a book that I was really excited to work on. You know, I mean, we both kind of took a chance on each other a bit. You know, I've had some books out with some relatively well-known folks, but. This was something I was really, really excited to do, and I think it's the type of book that'll be around. I think it'll be making sales for a long time. I think it's just that kind of a book that someone's going to be like, you know, not just whatever happened with that case, but it is an important case, and I think people will discover it. People will write about it. It'll get noticed by different groups of people for a long time. So it's been a very positive experience for me as well.
Right on. I want to thank you both, Gil Valley and Brian Whitney, for coming on and talking about this. Is there a Facebook page? And if people would want to contact one of you to talk about this project or comments, tell us a little bit about how people might find out where you are and some of your work.
Well, I'm very active on social media. You know, like I said, I'm not hiding from any of this, so I'm on Twitter, and a lot of people have found me that way. Readers of the book have reached out to me and, you know, wished me the best and have offered all kinds of encouragement. So I don't have a personal website. I'm just on Twitter. My handle is GilValley3. It's very simple. So people can feel free to reach out to me on there. And I welcome it. You know, I love talking and interacting with people who read the book or have questions about. I'm very open. That's one thing that I think Brian realized, is I literally answer every question. So it's all part of moving on and accepting this part of my life and just not hiding from anything, you know, and it's worked out very well. So people should feel free to reach out.
I know.
And just as far as I go, yeah, I was just going to say, I have a website, brianwhitneyauthor.com, and I'm also on Facebook. And Dan, again, thanks for having us on. I really appreciate you having read the book and asking the insightful questions that you've asked. I appreciate it.
Well, I want to thank you very much, guys, Gil and Brian, for coming on and talking about this. I thoroughly enjoyed this interview, and I really enjoyed the book. I really enjoyed the idea that I had preconceived ideas before I read this book, and you guys do an admirable job of stating the case and exploring this entire story and really bringing it home to understand the plight that Gill Valley went through this. I'm sure that, again, you're not taking responsibility for what happened, but certainly I can agree, and I think everyone can agree, that it surely didn't deserve a day in prison. So I want to thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Again, like Brian said, I think you're one of the first people who have actually read the book to interview us. So
it is kind of funny, yeah.
Yeah.
It's strange, isn't it?
We really appreciate you taking the time to do that and ask some very good, insightful questions. So thanks, Dan. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, and you guys have a great night, and all the best of luck to you with this, and talk to you again soon. Thank you. Good night.
Thanks,
Dan. Okay. Thanks very
good
much.
Night.
Bye.